The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, we'll share with you information from various medical sources. From the Costco Connection, helpful drugs must be used cautiously. Antibiotic is the question. What? We've all gone to the doctor feeling miserable with the flu-like symptoms, hoping we'll get an antibiotic that will quickly make us feel better. There are more than 100 types of antibiotics, each targeting specific bacterial infections. They kill the bacteria or weaken it so the patient's immune system can fight it off. As helpful as these medications can be, they are a mixed blessing. Sometimes they don't do the trick. Sometimes they make you sicker, and collectively their use and overuse is leading to dangerous superbugs. Antibiotics help heal and save lives. Antibiotics are cost-effective drugs that help patients recover from sickness and save lives. They are superheroes, playing a key role in preventing the spread of disease and in minimizing serious complications that can be associated with infections. In fact, it's estimated that the widespread use of antibiotics has extended life expectancy by 20 years, according to a 2014 study published in the British Journal of General Practice. Antibiotics can harm patients. Unfortunately, there are potential downsides to the use of antibiotics. They have become so commonplace in the U.S. hospitals that approximately half of all hospitalized patients receive antibiotics at some point during their stay. This high rate of usage can be harmful, according to the research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. A substantial proportion of antimicrobial use in the U.S. acute care hospitals may be inappropriate based on the factors such as lack of indication or incorrect drug selection, dosing levels, or treatment duration. Why does this matter? A recent study of almost 1,500 patients at the Johns Hopkins Hospital found that 20% of patients developed at least one antibiotic-related adverse event, or an ADE. These included abnormalities or harm to the gastrointestinal, skin, musculoskeletal, blood, kidney, cardiac, and neurological systems. What's more, researchers found that 20% of patients who developed an ADE, or an adverse drug event, had been given antibiotics that were clinically unnecessary. As common as antibiotics are in hospitals, the majority of prescriptions for oral antibiotics are written by doctors and other health practitioners in outpatient settings, accounting for 269 million antibiotic prescriptions in 2015. More than 40% of these prescriptions were written for respiratory conditions that, in most cases, would have resolved themselves without antibiotics. The Center for Disease Control estimates that 30% of all antibiotics prescribed in an outpatient setting are unnecessary. Antibiotic-resistant superbugs are a growing problem. Also, the overuse of antibiotics has led to the rise of antibiotic-resistant superbugs that, as the name suggests, do not respond to treatment. A resistance develops to every antibiotic drug at some point, sometimes quickly, according to the 2017 study published in the JAMA Internal Medicine. This problem has become so great that there is speculation that antibiotic-resistant superbugs may kill more people than cancer in the coming decades. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that in the U.S., more than 2 million people are sickened every year with antibiotic-resistant infections, with at least 23,000 dying as a result. The estimates are based on conservative assumptions and are likely minimum estimates. The overuse of antibiotics extends well beyond the U.S. The World Health Organization, or WHO, just released guidelines that provide advice on which antibiotics to use for common infections and which to preserve for the most serious circumstances. The goal of these new guidelines is to ensure that antibiotics are available when needed and that the right antibiotics are prescribed for the right infections. And you can find that on the internet at who.int/search antibiotic guidelines, quote unquote. Can antibiotic problems be solved? Who, WHO, World Health Organization, expects its guidelines will improve patient outcomes, reduce the development of drug-resistant bacteria, and maintain the effectiveness of last-resort antibiotics that are essential when all other options don't work. It could be a while before significant improvements are seen. Doctors and other clinicians will have to alter their prescribing habits. Patients will have to better understand what ailments antibiotics can and cannot help, and the risks in taking these medicines unnecessarily, and ultimately stop demanding them even when advised against their use. Additionally, it can be hard for doctors to resist patient demands, and doctors who prescribe fewer antibiotics tend to have lower patient satisfaction scores. What should you do? There are simple steps you can take to reduce your risk of antibiotic-related problems and to help reduce the development of antibiotic resistance. Here are a few. First and foremost, try to avoid getting infections so you won't need the antibiotics in the first place. According to the CDC, you can prevent drug-resistant infections by getting recommended immunizations, following safe food preparation guidelines, regularly washing your hands and with soap and water, and using antibiotics as directed and only when necessary. Next, if you are prescribed an antibiotic, ask if it is necessary or if it is being prescribed as a precaution. If it's being used preventively, ask what other steps can be taken. Ask specifically about antibiotic resistance. Next, use antibiotics only as prescribed. Take the appropriate dosage each day and then be sure to take all the medication. If you are taking antibiotics and miss a dose, contact your doctor for advice. To avoid this issue, set reminders for yourself using your phone or other alarm devices. Never take antibiotics that are left over from a previous illness or that were prescribed to someone else. And then finally, don't pressure your doctor to give you an antibiotic. If your doctor doesn't think you need one, ask for advice on managing your symptoms in other ways. Gut check from the Costco Connection. Life-saving screening for colon cancer. The most important thing to know about colon cancer screening is that you need to do it and do it regularly starting at age 50. Colon cancer, which is also called colorectal cancer or CRC and includes cancer of the rectum, is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, it is almost completely preventable through regular screening, says Dr. David Greenwalt, Director of Clinical Gastroenterology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. When we screen for colon cancer, we're looking for polyps, which are precancer. If we find any, we remove them before they turn into cancer. So we have an opportunity to prevent cancer from ever developing, explains Dr. Greenwalt. So why is CRC still a leading cause of cancer deaths if it's mostly preventable? Because even though screening rates for colon cancer have increased over the last decade, a third of the population eligible to be screened just doesn't do it. Barriers to screening include fear, access, money, and time. Fortunately, more tests are available than ever before to help break down these barriers. The United States Preventive Services Task Force issued a new CRC screening guidelines in 2016, which recommended more screening tests than the 2008 guidelines, including easy-to-use stool-based tests. The key to any screening test is that you want it to be easy, efficient, and effective. I think the options that are out there are all good, says Dr. Christopher Lien, the director of gastrointestinal medical oncology at the University of Colorado Cancer Center. Screening options. The USPSTF recommends regular screening from age 50 until 75 for people who have an average risk. People who are over 75 or who have high risk factors such as a family history of CRC or an inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's or colitis should consult their doctor about the right screening schedule for them. Some screening tests look for polyps and early signs of colon cancer, while others mainly look for signs of cancer. Tests that detect both polyps and cancer include colonoscopy. This procedure is the most commonly used for colon cancer screening, says Greenwalt, because the person performing it is able to detect polyps and remove them at the same time. During this test, a specialist looks at the entire colon and rectum while you're under sedation. A negative result means you'll need this test only once a decade. Flexible sigmoidoscopy. This test is similar to a colonoscopy, but a specialist looks at only the left side of the colon, where most colon cancers lurk. Sedation is usually not necessary. Lou says that if you opt for sigmoidoscopy, which you should do every 5 years, you should also do a stool-based test every year or two to maximize the chances of cancer detection. Also, if polyps or cancer are detected, you'll need a colonoscopy so a specialist can examine the results of the colon. Computed tomography, colonography. Can't pronounce it. A specialist uses X-ray images and a computer to look at your entire colon. Rarely will you need sedation. If no abnormalities are detected, you should do this test every 5 years. If a polyp or cancer is detected, you'll need a colonoscopy. Stool-based tests. These tests are less expensive, less invasive, and don't require any bowel prep or sedation. However, if you get an abnormal result, you'll need a colonoscopy. If you get a positive result and don't follow up with a colonoscopy, it's an inadequate screening, warns Greenwalt. Stool-based tests include fecal immunochemical test, or FIT, and guaiac-based fecal occult blood test, or GFOBT. With these two tests, a stool sample is taken at home and sent to a lab for analysis. While these tests are more convenient because you can do them at home, you need to do them annually to maximize their effectiveness. Stool DNA, a.k.a. FIT DNA. This newer test, approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2014, combines a FIT, F-I-T, and a test that looks for altered DNA in your stool. Abnormal pieces of DNA are the building blocks for cancer cells, explains Greenwalt. According to the American Cancer Society, a negative result means you can repeat it every 3 years as opposed to annually. Which test is right for you? While a colonoscopy is considered by many to be the gold standard of CRC screening, a less invasive test may be a better choice for you, especially if you can't tolerate sedation well or have a serious health issue. You should speak to your doctor about your health history, your preferences, and your insurance coverage to figure out the best screening option. Choosing any of them is the right one because you're getting screened, says Lou. Wall Street Journal. For liver transplants, less invasive donor surgery. Advocates say the method could get more living donors to come forward. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. The patient in the operating room was Stanley Coretta, a 29-year-old Army captain who had agreed to donate half of his liver to his wife's father. The older man had a liver disease so advanced that his only hope of survival was a transplant. But with about 14,000 people on the nation's waiting list for donor livers, most of which come from deceased donors, there was little chance he would be approved for one in time. His only option was to find a living donor willing to give up part of his or her liver for transplant. In this procedure, surgeons cut off part of the healthy person's liver and transplant it into a patient suffering from end-stage liver disease. With the liver's extraordinary ability to regenerate, both the donor and the recipient typically enjoy a full recovery. It's rarely done. This type of procedure isn't without risk, however, and because doctors are often reluctant to subject healthy people to such a major operation, and few living donors step forward, it is rarely performed. Adding to the challenge in Captain Coretta's case, Adel Bazargod, the chief organ transplantation at UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts, had decided on a surgical approach still in its infancy. Rather than making a large incision in the abdomen, he would use laparoscopy, a minimally invasive but technically challenging technique. Surgeons often use minimally invasive techniques to repair heart defects and knees and to remove gallbladders, ovaries, and esophageal cancer. This approach can lead to faster recovery, less pain, and fewer wound infections and incision hernias. But only a handful of surgeons in the U.S. are doing liver donations with laparoscopy, both because ethical concerns about operating on live donors make them cautious about trying a new approach, and because this particular surgery is technically challenging. In the U.S. last year, just 367 of 8,082 liver transplants came from live donors, says the Department of Health and Human Services Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network. Just a fraction of those were done with laparoscopy. If surgeons perform more live donor liver transplants using laparoscopy, the procedure's supporters say it would encourage more donors to step forward, and that could reduce the thousands of deaths in the U.S. each year of people waiting for liver to become available from a deceased donor, the more usual method. Each day, about 22 people on the waiting list for liver transplant receive transplants, while about 7 die or are removed from the list because they have become too near death for surgery before liver becomes available, the Organ Network says. A challenging operation. However it's done, liver donation surgery is considered one of the most challenging operations there is. It is sometimes said to be like trying to cut a big piece of watermelon without disturbing any of the seeds inside. Minuscule blood vessels and bile ducts run throughout the organ. The surgeon has to divide them with precision, and there is no room for error. Deaths of liver donors are rare but do occur in an estimated 1 out of 500 cases. Open liver surgery generally involves an L-shaped incision halfway across the donor's stomach, from hip to belly button, and all the way up the chest. The incision can be as much as a foot and a half long and requires cutting through core abdominal muscles. The laparoscopic approach, by contrast, makes only small incisions. Shorter recovery time means donors can return to their normal lives faster, including heavy physical work. Benjamin Samstein, chief of liver transplantation at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center, has led the way in bringing laparoscopic liver donor surgery to the U.S. Last year, his team did 12 of its 19 donor operations using a fully laparoscopic approach. Dr. Samstein says his aim is to greatly increase access to liver transplants by making it easier to be a donor. He says the number of live kidney donors nearly doubled in 10 years when laparoscopic donor surgery was introduced in 1995, an increase experts believe was due in large part to laparoscopy. Live kidney donors used to be almost always first degree, relatives, parents, children, and siblings. But with laparoscopic surgery, people felt more comfortable reaching out to people throughout their communities, says Dr. Samstein. A 2015 paper by Dr. Samstein published in Liver Transplantation and based on 42 cases, mostly adults donating livers to children, found significant advantages for laparoscopy over open surgery. Though operating time was longer, blood loss was less, hospital stay was shorter, and return to work was far faster. Open surgery patients took, on average, 63 days to return to work, while donors who had endoscopic surgery took 34 days. But even among surgeons who believe it's crucial to encourage more living donors, some argue that urging doctors to perform laparoscopy isn't the way to do it. The whole picture. We have to concentrate on the whole picture, not on one technique or the other, says Robert Fisher, chief of transplantation at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Fisher says he isn't opposed to laparoscopy, but feels more comfortable sticking with the techniques he has been using safely. Transplant specialists can do more to gain society's trust in conventional surgery, says, and advanced pain control methods can be almost as effective as laparoscopy or at reducing recovery times. To others, though, the potential for increasing the supply of liver donors is a compelling argument for the laparoscopic approach. The big question in everyone's mind, says Dr. Bozorgeda of UMass Medical Center, should be, is it okay to let thousands of people die a year waiting for a liver transplant while we say there are no organs? No, it is not, he says, because there are organs. They're in living donors. And if you learn to do this safely, the shortage is partially addressed. The doctor's surgery on Captain Coretta last summer was only his sixth laparoscopic liver donation. The doctor and his team, including Demetrius Litwin, an expert in minimally invasive surgery, inserted a small needle below Captain Coretta's rib cage to inflate his abdomen cavity with carbon dioxide gas. They then made four slits of less than a half inch each, through which they inserted surgical tools and a camera and a 4-inch incision called a hand port, through which Dr. Bozorgeda slipped a hand that eventually brought it out the portion of the liver going to the captain's father-in-law in the operating room next door. Captain Coretta's surgery was completed July 11th. He left the hospital after 6 days, taking only ibuprofen for pain, and returned to work on August 17th, about 5 weeks after the surgery. The median time for patients to return to light work after open liver donation surgery is 9 to 12 weeks, according to a 2017 paper in National Reviews in Gastroenterology and Hepatology. By October, Captain Coretta was wearing his usual equipment for field exercises, including body armor and a rucksack, which together weighed about 65 pounds. Asked whether his relationship with his father-in-law has changed, he says no, but then chuckles. He did send me a birthday card on his birthday saying, "Thank you," inside. I think he plans on sending me one for the rest of his life. From the Harvard Health Letter, sexually transmitted disease at my age. There's an upswing in cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis in the United States, and includes older adults. For as long as humans have engaged in sex, they have been sexually transmitted diseases, or STDs. The term STD, which has replaced the older venereal disease, generally refers to infections that can be transmitted by vaginal, anal, or oral sex. Among them are genital herpes, human papillomavirus virus, chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. The CDC estimates that there are about 20 million new STD cases every year, but only a fraction of them get reported. STDs are on the rise in people of all ages. They were more common than 2 million reported. There were more than 2 million reported cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis in 2016. While the vast majority occurred in teenagers and young adults, there also were significant increases among middle-aged and older adults. For example, among people ages 55 to 64, reports of chlamydia cases nearly doubled between 2012-2016 from 49-50 to 93-21. Although we don't think of them that way, older adults appear to be increasing risk for STDs, says Dr. Katie Dioff, a reproductive infectious disease specialist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Why the increase in STDs in older adults? Dr. Dioff points to several possible reasons for the increase in STDs among older adults. For example, they often don't get STD screening and treatment because both they and their doctors are often reluctant to raise the issue. Their immune systems lose some ability to fight off disease with age, which may make it harder to fight an infection. They may start dating more than one partner after divorce or the death of a partner, raising their risk for infection after a long period of monogamy. Compared with previous generations, they have an easier time having sex at older age, thanks to the availability of medications such as Viagra. They are not accustomed to thinking of themselves or a partner as being at high risk for STDs. They may not be accustomed to using a condom or don't use one because they think they or their partners are not at risk for STDs. They may not consider oral or anal sex as a way of contracting or transmitting STDs. Symptoms and risks. In women, untreated chlamydia or gonorrhea can develop into painful pelvic inflammatory disease, which may require treatment with intravenous antibiotics and hospital admission. In men, these diseases can lead to infection of the urethra and pain when urinating. They also increase the risk of getting and transmitting HIV. But catching them early is difficult since they don't always cause symptoms. If you can detect those STDs early, treatment is a course of antibiotics. Gonorrhea has become highly resistant to antibiotics, however. Syphilis is more likely than gonorrhea or chlamydia to cause symptoms. It may start as a sore in the genital area or around the mouth. After a few weeks, there may be a rash on the hands or feet, more sores, fever, muscle and joint pain, hair loss, and vision loss. If syphilis is not treated, it can lead to complications such as heart damage or dementia. But unlike with gonorrhea, treatment is simple. It's an injection of penicillin, and it's 99% effective. Prevention. To protect yourself against STDs, be vigilant. The best way is with condoms. You also need to be screened for STDs. Get annual testing if you have any new partners. Second opinion. I always thought I was allergic to the antibiotic penicillin, but my doctor did an allergy test, and it turns out I'm not. How is that possible? And this is from the Mayo Clinic health letter. An estimated 10% of people have been diagnosed as having an allergy to penicillin at some point in their lives. Having a penicillin allergy on your medical record is taken seriously because the allergic reaction can sometimes be harmful or fatal. However, studies using skin testing for penicillin allergy have found that about 90% of those with penicillin allergy on their medical records are not allergic to penicillin. In other words, about 1% of the population is allergic, not 10%. It's possible that an original allergy diagnosis was actually a side effect unrelated to allergy, such as having an upset stomach or diarrhea. Penicillin-based drugs are commonly prescribed and an important class of antibiotics. If you have positive allergy skin test to penicillin, a desensitization process may be considered if there's a strong reason to use penicillin for your circumstances. Desensitization involves giving you a small dose of penicillin drug, then gradually increasing that dose in a controlled and gradual way until you are able to tolerate a full dose. It's performed in a medically supervised setting. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.